You're listening to C2Y Podcast. We bring you discussions on child and youth care that feature conversations with young people, parents, and professionals about the youth social service system. Introducing your host, Wolfgang Vachon.
Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. I live in Toronto, Canada. Statistically speaking, I live in a very safe city in a very safe country. However, many young people living in this country face violence. Violence within families, violence within peer groups, and violence within structures designed to support them. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Totten, who has just published his fourth book called Gang Life, 10 of the Toughest Tell Their Story. Violence is the tough reality in these stories. The people who share their lives have a history of abuse as children and all committed disturbingly violent acts as adolescents and adults. It's a difficult and important book to read. Difficult for the violence and important for the insights. Dr. Mark Totten is an educator, researcher, writer, social worker, and a parent. To learn more about the work he does, you can visit c2ypodcast.org for a list of his books and a link to his website, Totten and Associates, which has many of his publications available to read. Welcome and thank you for joining me, Mark.
Thank you, Wolfgang.
So you conclude the book, just as I started this podcast, on the topic of violence. You write in the book that most gang members experience brutalizing violence as children. What's the impact of violence on the people that you interviewed?
Well, you know, I've interviewed a couple hundred gang members across the country over the past decade or so, and the most common and recurring theme in their lives is the experience of severe violence, physical violence, sexual violence, severe neglect at a very, very young age. If we look at sexual abuse, just as an example, it's not just female gang members who experience sexual abuse, it's male gang members. The abuse is horrific. It starts at a very, very young age, and it tends to continue in the different contexts that, young people are in. So, you know, I have four or five women that I talk about in the book. All of them, with the exception of one, experienced sexual abuse starting at about the age of 4 or 5 years old. And this sexual abuse continued at school, in the community, and while they were in gangs. So, you know, experiencing extreme violence doesn't predict gang involvement, but it is certainly a key risk factor. And if young people experience other risk factors, like growing up in severe poverty, belonging to an antisocial peer group, growing up in the care of child welfare and youth justice systems, then all of those factors combined can set a young person for the stage of joining a gang later on.
You just did a very nice job of listing all those different risk factors, and we see them. We see them throughout the book. Everybody who you speak with gives us a list of the risk factors, the tragedies, the horrific abuse that they experienced growing up. What happened? Why did they end up in gangs? Why didn't the social service system step in to prevent it?
Well, you know, Canada is so far behind evidence-based practices in other countries. Here's the basic problem. We know who is going to become a serious and chronic offender by about the age of 6 or 7 years old. So we can predict with pretty good accuracy that kids at the age of 6 or 7 who have serious emotional and behavioral problems, they're being aggressive and violent with their siblings and their parents, they're being kicked out of school, they're too young to be diagnosed with a severe emotional or behavioral disorder. But these are the kids that if they don't get appropriate help and if their families don't get the appropriate help at that young age, then they very quickly are onto an early onset pathway into severe and violent offending. And some of them become gang involved. Now, the other very serious problem we have in this country is that the child welfare system and the youth justice system are two systems which we've spent a lot of time and resources, and there's a lot of history here, two systems designed to rehabilitate and protect young people. However, if we look at kids who are bounced around from pillar to post, they might experience 15 to 20 to 30 different foster homes and group homes. They're bounced around in the youth justice system. The outcomes for these kids are very poor. And one of the questions I always ask gang members is, you know, at what point did you meet other gang members? How did you get involved? And this is a very complicated area, but many of these kids will tell me that they met other gang-involved people in child welfare, youth justice facilities, or if that didn't happen, then when they were released from these facilities, they hooked up with their pals who were also incarcerated or in the same foster home, and they started to commit very serious crimes. So we've got a fundamental problem in this country, and if we can't figure out a way to provide these kids with a stable placement and not bouncing them around, then we're going to continue to experience relatively high rates of gang involvement for the kids who are bounced around from pillar to post.
The social service system is ostensibly set up to prevent exactly what the outcomes you're talking about. So what I'm hearing you say is that the social service system, as these young people experience it, is actually exacerbating the problem, that they meet potential gang members, and this certainly is highlighted in the book, in these locations. So why is that happening, that people go to a foster care or a group home and they meet and they develop gangs? They're going to jail and they're developing gangs rather than as a route out of that life.
Well, a big part of the problem is that we have the wrong mix of kids in a foster home or a group home or a secure custody facility. So if we look at the young offender system, the people who operate secure and open facilities really don't have much say over who lands there. So in a sentencing, the judge might say to a young person, let's say who's been convicted of attempted murder, might say, I'm going to sentence you to secure custody for X number of years. But that where that kid will actually end up, in which facility, the judge has no control over, and the people who run the facility have no control over it. So we've got a serious problem where we've got the wrong mix of kids. And what I mean by wrong mix is that we've got too many early onset high risk offenders, and we've got too few low risk late onset offenders. So let's take a typical open custody facility. There might be 8 beds in the facility. There might be one or two kids who are late onset, low risk kids, and there might be 6 kids who are early onset, high risk kids. And what happens to the low risk kids is that their competencies decrease. They go down the toilet simply because they're exposed to too many early onset kids. We've got a very similar problem in the child welfare system, where we don't do a good job in our intake assessments of figuring out, you know, which profile of kid needs to be in which facility. And so the low-risk kids, when they get exposed again to too many high-risk kids, they become worse. They become more antisocial. So we have to do a much better job at looking at what's the right mix of kids.
And what would the right mix be?
Well, the right mix would be, if we take again that 8-bed open custody facility, the right mix might be 6 late onset kids with 2 early onset kids. And what happens with that exposure is that the early onset, highly antisocial kids, their competencies will increase just because they're exposed to low risk offenders.
So how does that happen, Mark? How do we get
that? Well, we can't do anything about that, really, at the judicial level. The people who operate these facilities have no control. over who goes there. So what we need to do with judges and other people in the justice system, other professionals, is to educate them around this research and educate them about who gets worse given their exposure to high-risk kids. In the child welfare system, it's a bit different. There's a bit more control over where kids are placed, which foster homes or group homes. And, you know, so we're in a much better position there to be able to have the right grouping. But the fundamental problem with boys, and we see this a lot more with boys than girls, is that when we've got too many hyperactive, oppositional, defiant, or conduct-disordered boys, and we put them together in the same place, they get worse. They don't get better. And people do not want to hear that message.
I remember I was doing, running a center for counseling center, and we'd have lots of people who were sentenced there by the judges, and they would come and they'd be booked for, you know, 10 sessions. The judge said, you know, go and do 10 sessions of therapy and then, you know, we'll reduce your sentence or whatever. And so the people, you know, they'd often not show up, et cetera, et cetera. So we had this great idea of bringing them all together and doing group work with, you know, I'm a big fan of group work. So we bring them all together. We do group work with these young guys and women, and they're all connecting and they're all bonding and they're all developing relationships. And we're so happy with how successful it's all been. And they're all showing up. And then we find they're all getting rearrested together. Yeah. And we're thinking, what happened? What happened? And of course, once we start doing some digging around, we find that, just as you're saying, the evidence base counter indicates doing that sort of intervention program. So we know this. You say that Canada is far, far, far behind. Where is it working and what's different?
Well, if we look at the issue of severe child maltreatment, including child neglect, we can fill up Humber College, the typical classroom, with studies in different countries that show very clearly that in-home visitation by public health nurses, and I'll explain what that means in a second, that intervention can reduce the rates of physical abuse and neglect by as much as 60 to 70% in families. Now, what in-home visitation means, basically, and Olds, he's the grandfather of this research, what he did was he did randomized control trials. So he compared hundreds of thousands of high-risk kids who get the in-home visitation with hundreds of thousands of kids who don't get it. And then he followed them up over a generation. And the kids who had a nurse, a public health nurse, who visited their home a couple of times a week over a 3 or 4 year period, those kids did remarkably better in terms of having a successful transition into their adult lives compared to the same kinds of kids who didn't get that intervention. So again, we've got a massive body of research. And what do we do in Canada? Well, in certain high-risk communities, we do this, but it's not comprehensive. It's not done across the board. Every single family does not need this. The high-risk families do. And, you know, wouldn't it be fantastic if we could cut the rates of child maltreatment, let's say in some Toronto areas, by as much as 50 or 60 or 70%? That would be a very different world for kids. But in Canada, it's not politically sexy to do that because you don't see the positive outcome in a kid's life, you know, for maybe 5-10 years down the road.
So the nurses come in, and I assume that these are the young people, you're talking about the 5, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds who are having those behavioral issues, or, you know, experiencing violence in the home, or perpetuating violence against others, et cetera, et cetera. So we identify these young people and a nurse goes into the home. So I'm intrigued that it's a public health nurse as opposed to a social worker or a child and youth care worker or some other social service professional. Why is a nurse, and what does the nurse do there?
Well, actually, Wolfgang, it starts much earlier, before the age of 5 or 6. So in the communities that do this well, the public health nurse will connect with every single high-risk mother who is about to have a kid. And so the intervention actually starts before the woman gets pregnant. Wow. Or when she's first pregnant. So it starts with good baby care and good care of the fetus. And that way we can get at preventing fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which has a huge impact. And many Aboriginal gang members have FASD. The other thing that public health nurses can focus on is violence against women. So we know that women who are in abusive relationships are highly likely to have kids who have serious problems. Part of that includes kids being beaten while they're in the womb and brain damage results. So if a public health nurse can work with a pregnant high-risk mom around increasing her safety and maybe getting her boyfriend or her husband the help that he needs to stop being abusive, or maybe support that woman in leaving the relationship. These are critical things, critical points of intervention. But again, it starts way before we start seeing these aggressive antisocial kids at the age of 5 or 6. And that's why a public health nurse is so important, because that nurse, typically it's a woman, can look at physical health problems, mental health problems, and in the communities that do it right, there's a one-stop shopping center. And so the public health nurse would work on a team with a social assistance worker, an employment worker, a child care program. And often what also happens is that these low-income, high-risk moms are given basically free recreation for their kids. And this is a huge carrot, because you've got to give a carrot to these families. So, for example, in Hamilton and in other parts of the country, Edmonton, where they have what's called a Families First program, a mother might get $600 or $700 for each of her kids per year to spend it on recreation or sports or arts. That mother could say, well, I want my kids enrolled in swimming. Okay, it's going to cost this much money. Or I want to buy skates for my kids. Or I want to, you know, enroll them in downhill skiing. And then they basically get this amount of money every year. And that's a huge benefit to a single parent mom who's growing up in poverty.
When you bring this data forward, you've written extensively in your books and reports and articles. You bring this data forward. You say, here are the risk factors. Here's what's successful. Here's what the child welfare system and the criminal justice system is doing incorrectly. What's the response?
Well, that depends. It depends upon how big the community is. When I provide this kind of data to politicians and policy folks and frontline folks, so that message in Toronto basically gets swallowed up into a large mass of administration and basically goes nowhere. However, if I go into a place like Prince Albert in northern Saskatchewan, you know, a community of 20,000-25,000 people, or if I go onto a remote reserve that's having problems with addiction and gangs and violence, it's much easier to get this message across and actually do something positive in a small community. So, for example, on a reserve, I've done a lot of work on remote reserves. Let's say, for example, they're having serious problems around child maltreatment, violence against women, maybe gang involvement. The intervention goes like this. You sit down with chief and council, and you say, look, you know, these are some of the problems that I'm seeing. You're seeing the same thing. We've got 500 people on this reserve. So let's set a plan. Let's identify those families that need help and get them the help that they need. You try and do that in Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal, even Ottawa. Holy cow. Trying to get all of the social service providers into the same room is just about impossible. And trying to get the ears of politicians and policy people who really have, you know, a great amount of influence over developing these kinds of approaches is very, very difficult, because there's so many people and there is so much turf wars that are going on. You know, that like in Toronto, for example, there are hundreds and hundreds of agencies agencies that help kids, hundreds of social agencies, and everybody's fighting for their share of the pie, and particularly when revenues are decreasing. So people are afraid to step outside of the mandate of their organization because they fear that their funding might get cut. So this is a very, very complicated thing to do. It's very, very frustrating. And what I've learned over the years is that the best kind of approach is one family at a time, one kid at a time. And if you can make a significant difference with one family or one kid in the community, then that can have a huge impact on the level of violence or the level of gang activity in the community.
So let's say that, as often happens, that these structures do not go into place. And this isn't just Canada, of course. There's many, many countries. And some countries have much, you know, we hear about gang involvement and gang violence much more than we even hear about in Canada. So these systems are not in place. These young people do not get the support they need. They become adolescents. You write about the how and the why of gang involvement, and you say that the how is much easier to understand than the why. And you've started giving us a nice understanding of the foundational moment, that exposure to violence, that exposure to trauma, that abuse, that neglect, that system not taking care. There's many people who have had very, very difficult, horrific childhoods, have many risk factors, and they don't end up in gangs. What tips that one individual into gangs and another into soccer or football or some other community other than a gang?
Well, excellent question. And here's what we know. We know that, yeah, you're absolutely right, the vast majority of kids that grow up in severe deprivation, poverty, where they experience violence or trauma, the vast majority of those kids do okay. And it's only a slim minority that become very violent offenders, gang involved. And so here's what we know. We know that what we call risk factors and protective factors, there's a dynamic mixture of these issues in a young person's life. And kids who grow up in terrible situations can have a good outcome if they have one or more of three things. The first thing is having a stable, healthy adult who is there with them through thick and thin. And it doesn't have to be a parent. It could be another family relative. It could be a teacher. It could be the auto mechanic down the road. But the key is the healthy mentoring over a long period of time in childhood and adolescence. So that's number one, the presence of a helping, caring, healthy adult. If kids have that and they grow up in very bad situations, they can turn out fine. The second thing we know is that if kids are bonded to school, and bonding means not only doing well at school, but attending school regularly and liking something at school, and that something can be the janitor, and the kid works with the janitor to build props for the school play. That kid is bonded to school because he or she likes what is going on at school. So school bonding. Kids who grew up in terrible situations and who are bonded at school, they can do very well as well. The third factor is the mastery over a skill. Typically, this comes from some kind of activity outside of the family and outside of the school. So we know that kids who participate regularly in recreation or arts or sports, and they develop mastery over a skill. It could be kicking a soccer ball, singing in the choir, sculpting with clay. It doesn't matter. But when those activities are done over the long term throughout childhood and adolescence, then kids who grew up in terrible situations turn out okay. So three factors, and kids who have at least one of those factors can turn out pretty well.
How do we ensure that those children that we didn't support in infancy and pregnancy and their early development, how do we, as social service professionals, how do we ensure that that happens with them in adolescence?
Well, this is a very difficult thing to do because typically what we social service folks do is we do an assessment at some point in a kid's life, a psychosocial assessment. So how is that kid functioning at home, in their peer group, at school, you know, in various sectors? And typically we do that assessment after there's blood on the floor, so after there's a crisis. And typically our assessment is not what we would call a strengths-based assessment, but it is a pathology-based assessment where we're assessing for problems. We're not assessing for what's going right. So if we were to wind back the clock and do that kind of assessment in a supportive way with a high-risk mother, maybe before she has kids or once her kids are born, then what we can do is we can offer some carrots, right? And the carrots could be free recreation for her kids. But then at the same time, we can introduce more intrusive services like a public health nurse, maybe it's child welfare, youth justice. And so we've got to turn our traditional assessment process basically on its ear. And we have to do it a lot earlier. We need to have what we call a single point access in the community so families aren't being assessed to death. And quite often we do that, right? It's, you know, if a family knocks on one door, then that agency will do an assessment. Then maybe knocks on another door and there's a similar assessment done by a different agency. And the mandates are very, very narrow. So if we can get around all of those issues, and if we can identify in a supportive way those kids who are going to turn into serious and violent offenders, but identify them at a really, really young age, then our chances are very, very good at developing a plan and supporting the family and that child to deal with the trauma or the violence or whatever else is at the root of their problem behavior. But again, you know, this is a radical shift in the way that we traditionally do business. But I think we owe it. We owe it to kids and we owe it to families to do a much better job at this.
Certainly reading your latest book, it's hard to not feel anger and sadness and all the rest, you know, and just the level of violence is striking, and any romantic notions that may be portrayed about gangs really gets diminished very, very quickly. And I'm struck by the level of brutal, brutal violence that many of these young people experienced, done to them, done to others while they're in the gang. What does the gang give these young people?
Well, in chapter two, I talk about Terrence, who's 33 years old now. And I first met Terrence, oh boy, it was about 20 years ago, and I was a social worker. And Terrence was adopted with his sister into a mixed-race family. He came from a mixed-race biological family. And he was terribly neglected. So basically his diet consisted of pizza crusts until he was adopted into another family. And he was violent at a very, very young age. And he went from psychiatrist to psychologist to social worker, and he never fit. There was no organization that had the right mandate to address his complex needs. So he started on a pathway of both internalized and externalized violence. So he attempted suicide regularly, but at the same time, he was doing things like curb stomping, where he would force the head of a student at school onto a concrete curb and then basically stomp this person's head, breaking their jaw and their teeth, and very, very violent act. He was in and out of custody at a young age. He met other antisocial kids. When he got out, he committed serious crimes with his friends, and eventually he set up his own drug crew. And this kid, Terrence, is exceptionally bright, and part of the problem was that he was so bright that he was always placed with older kids. Because he just got bored, you know. So in grade 4 or 5, he was so bored that they bumped him up into grade 6, 7, or 8. And so, you know, what happened with him was that after I worked with him for maybe a year, and it made absolutely no difference in his life. I did not do a good job, and his needs were too complex. I would read about him and hear about him in the media. You know, very, very serious and violent offender. And his job basically was a debt collector and enforcer for organized crime groups, so outlaw motorcycle gangs, mafia groups. They would send him in to collect drug debts or other forms of debts. And what Terrence would do is he would use the threat of severe violence and actual severe violence to do this. And so I talk about one instance where he actually cut off the finger of somebody who ratted out a gang member to the police. And Terrence basically walked into this guy's place, said, "You're a rat. Which finger did you use to rat somebody out?" The guy pointed up his index finger. He took out a pair of gardening shears, and the finger was gone. And then he brought that back to the outlaw motorcycle gang and said, "Here's the finger. Now you got to pay me." You know, but at the same time that he was doing this, he was jumping off bridges. He was hanging himself. And so we see this very dialectical process of trying to kill himself at the same time that he was trying to kill other people. Now, complicating things was that he was a chronic steroid abuser, and he also trafficked steroids, and he was also a crack addict. And so when he got high on steroids and on crack, you know, he would go into these rages, you know, and so... You know, here's a kid adopted into an affluent family, terribly neglected until the age of two, got involved with the wrong crowd in various justice facilities, uses extreme violence, and then, you know, what he did was he found God when he came up for parole hearing, and he was able to convince the parole board that what he needed was a residential treatment facility that basically was focused on organized religion. And he is such a charmer, this guy. But at the same time, he you know, he's a sociopath. He's totally unable to understand the harm that he causes to people. And he is so manipulative. So, you know, the question is, could this all have been prevented? I think it could have. It could have been prevented if he had not fallen through the cracks at a very young age. If a psychiatrist or psychologist or social worker would have stood up and said, you know, you are falling through the cracks, this family is falling through the cracks, we're going to basically design an intervention which is going to meet the complexity of your needs, then all of this could have been prevented.
And so... going back to what he received out of it, because as you explain the story, Mark, I hear this young person who desperately wants to leave this, right, to the point where he wants to end his own life, and yet he seems unable to extricate himself from it. Why does he stay, or is that a silly question to ask?
No, it's an excellent question. You know, so what's working for him? You know, what did he get out of this kind of violent gang involvement? Well, number one, he got easy access to his drugs, to steroids and crack cocaine. So sometimes, instead of being paid $20,000 or $30,000, then the gang would give him a kilo of cocaine. You know, so easy access to drugs, number one. Number two, the size of this guy, he didn't fit through the doorway. We did an interview with him at his girlfriend's place when he was out on parole, and he is massive. He is such, I mean, you and I both work out, but this guy, it's very, very hard to explain without seeing him, but he got a rush out of that because he would basically say, "Hey, you know, here's my steroid line imported from Europe, came up to Canada through the States. It does a really good job. Look at me. Look at how muscular I am." And basically he would use his size to get his clientele to buy steroids. But as a man, you know, when we look at how he portrayed his masculinity, his size was a key element of that. you know, so very, very interesting character, but very, very sad at the same level. You know, and I actually remember 20, 25 years ago sitting down with the psychiatrist who had tried to do an assessment with him. And the psychiatrist, very, very prominent guy, very, very skilled, basically threw up his hands and said, you know what, every single test that we have done with this kid, he has lied and manipulated every single question. He's manipulated all of the psychologists and psychiatrists who are administering the tests, so we can't help him. He basically threw up his hands. And you know what? I was young back then, and I didn't understand the importance of, you know, of being very, very forceful in a positive way, advocating for a specialized set of services for this kid. I remember being Terrence's social worker 20, 25 years ago, and we had a prominent psychiatrist who was trying to do an assessment on this kid to try and open up an envelope of services that would help him and his family. And Terrence was so smart and so manipulative at a very young age, he would have been maybe 10, 11, or 12 years old, that he basically tricked and fooled his way into appearing to be a very bright kid who was very social. And in reality, he was the exact opposite. He was very, very bright, but he was highly antisocial. And so I remember sitting in a meeting with a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, Mark, you know, there's nothing we can do for this kid. He fools all of the tests. He is manipulative. And there's nothing we can do because he does not want to engage in any kind of service. And, you know, looking back on it, I think I could have been more forceful in my advocacy for this kid. I mean, I certainly wasn't the cause of his descent into gang life, but I certainly was an element of it going back into the childhood of this guy. So I think all this could have been prevented. You know, I don't believe that he would have turned out to be an addicted, violent gang member who regularly tried to kill himself if we would have been able to put in place the right mix of services when he was a child.
You know, you tell the story of Terrence and the psychiatrist, and, you know, part of me is smiling when, you know, I hear the story about this young adolescent who can manipulate all the psychologists and psychiatrists, and I think, yes, there's so much there that there's a young person who has this set of capacities, and how do we tap into those and not see it as, oh, that person's incorrigible and he's a write-off because he's smarter than me, but say, wow, that person is brilliant and can get his needs met, and how do I support that so we don't end up down that other road. As we move towards the end of this conversation, I'd like to talk about the end of gang life. We've talked a lot of time about how to prevent the different intervention points. You've done some really important work around gang exit programs. What works in gang exit programs, and how do we reach young people who are in gangs to transition them out?
Well, that's a good question. The National Crime Prevention Center in Canada, which is part of Public Safety Canada, has been very, very good at funding five-year anti-gang programs. And I've had the luxury of evaluating three of those programs. One of them is going on right now in Manitoba. And we've learned some very, very important lessons. So let me try and divide this into two chunks. Helping hardened gang members who are, you know, 30, 40 years old get out of gangs when they want to. We've got one set of programs with that. And then we've got another set of programs which prevent kids who are at high risk of gang involvement, helping them resist gang activity. So what do we know? We know that we need to have a community-wide and coordinated set of interventions. these types of programs work well when they are holistic and when they are basically partnered with other organizations relevant to the health of young people and gang members. So if we look at what works in terms of preventing high-risk kids from joining gangs, we know that the school bonding is very, very important. And we know that culture is very important as well. So if we look at Aboriginal gang members for a second, what types of schooling work? The type of schooling that works are schooling that has a very low ratio of teachers to students. Maybe it's, you know, 4 students for every teacher. And where the foundation of the program is based upon traditional healing and culture. So schooling's important. We know that structuring leisure time is very important. So key gangbanging times tend to be at night and, you know, into early morning. So we need to operate these programs really at times that most social workers don't want to work, you know, and that's very important. We know that mental health issues are very important. So in the programs that I've evaluated for high-risk kids, about 25% of those kids regularly try and kill themselves. So we've got to be able to focus on mental health needs. We also know that fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which results in brain damage, is very, very important to deal with. We know that parenting programs are very important. So many gang members have lots of kids, and many youth who are at high risk of gang membership also have kids. You know, so it's this combination of a holistic set of services which are geared to meet the complexity of needs of young people and which involves a community-wide and coordinated approach. So that's one approach. The next target of intervention is adults who are heavily gang-involved who want to leave. And leaving a gang can be a very dangerous thing to do, particularly if you don't have other family members in a gang. So let me explain that for a sec. We know that some kids come from what I call super gang families. So they are literally born into a gang family. And they have a relatively easy time in joining the gang and leaving the gang because it's family. For the kids who don't have a familial attachment to gangs, it's much more violent in terms of the entry process and the exit process. So one of the things we've learned from the RAGS project, the Regina Anti-Gang Services Project, which was a 5-year project, is that we have to put in place measures that will reduce the risk of violence when somebody is in the process of exiting the gang. So that's very important. We also know that relocating gang members to other parts of the country where their gang is not active is also very important. So if we take, for example, a Hell's Angels gang member, it's almost impossible to relocate that person to a part of the country where the Hells Angels aren't active, because they're very, very active in most parts of the country. So we need to help gang members replace the lost income that they will have if they leave the gang. So how are they going to be able to support themselves? That's important. Schooling's important. The parenting's important. Addictions are a huge issue. So many high-ranking gang members have severe addictions. So we've got to be able to help with that. You know, and so again, what works is this holistic set of approaches which is culturally competent, you know, whether we're dealing with Aboriginal gang members or gang members who come from sub-Saharan Africa. Culture has to be a very important cornerstone of the intervention. And we have to expect that leaving the gang is going to take years. Most gang members that make a decision to leave, and it might take them 3 or 4 years to completely leave the gang. And so we've got to be patient. We've got to have programs that will stick with that gang member and support their exit over many, many years. Another thing that's really important is relationships with the local police, with the local gang unit. We know that gang members who are able to bond with police officers who have a focus on gang activity, when that relationship is healthy and positive, then it really works if that police officer can mentor that person who's trying to get out of the gang. So very, very difficult thing to do. The good news, though, is that in Canada, we know what works.
It's hopeful that things do work, because often you know, one of the titles of your other books was Nasty, Brutish, and Short. And, you know, that certainly is the perception of many of the people that this book, associates of people that you interviewed in this book, their lives were ended, you know, murdered, suicide, overdose, et cetera, et cetera. So it's great to hear that there is hope. And it's also really important to hear how we get there all along the way. So I want to thank you for taking the time. There's so many more questions that I had. I think I asked two questions that I'd actually written down in this interview. And so many other things came up, issues of race, issues of misogyny and sexual violence, issues of self-care for you, issues of how we work as individuals, social service providers with individuals and gangs. So many great questions. But the nice thing to know is that the information is all out there. And I really, really encourage people to pick up your book, Gang Life, 10 of the Toughest, Tell Their Stories, as well as your other books, and to visit Totten and Associates. And again, the link is on c2ypodcast.org to read your other work, to get into what works. And thank you so much, Mark, for all of your work in this field and for taking the time to speak with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Wolfgang.
Bye-bye for now.
Okay, bye-bye.
This concludes this month's episode of C2Y Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher and visit us at c2ypodcast.org.